Republicans in Iowa and Tommy Tuberville makes his stand. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National U podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Waterstone and the Free the Economy podcast from CEI. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, late last week, we had this forum out in Iowa, a cattle call where all the cattle, except for Donald Trump, showed up to get interviewed by Tucker Carlson. These interviews, of course, reflected Tucker's idiosyncratic causes and obsessions. The folks who got the best reception from the crowd were DeSantis, who I think acquitted himself quite nicely, and Vivek Ramaswamy, who I think is due a moment. The Ramaswamy moment may be upon us very soon. And you had Mike Pence having this exchange with Tucker that I thought Pence was right on the substance. This idea that you hear from Tucker and other neo-isolationists is that, you know, the only reason we have crime in American cities or a de facto open border in certain respects is because we're aiding Ukraine is completely absurd. But crowd didn't like Mike Pence's pushback. Plus, there was a bit of a gaffe there where he seemed to say that it was not his concern, the state of the country here domestically. It was not what he meant, not what he said, but people made hay of that. What did you make? What's your overall take from the event?
So for a long time on this podcast, when we've been discussing the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, the standard disclaimer is, well, it's early. There's still a lot of road ahead and all that stuff. I don't think it's early anymore. I think we're now in it. I think it is now the battle is joined. You're starting to see these sorts of events where the candidates all appear on the same stage. And I think if your name is not Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis, you're probably in trouble. You probably did not get off to the start that you wanted. And in fact, Ron DeSantis clearly did not get off to the start that he wanted. Maybe somebody like Vivek Ramaswamy can point to being at 8%.
Vivek?
Is it Vivek?
Yes, Vivek.
All right. I'm going to call him Ramaswamy just to be sure. Ramaswamy is at 7, 8% in a bunch of national polls. That's a little something to point to when you're not really well known heading into the cycle. But I think everybody else is in rough shape. I think you look at the fundraising numbers and cash on hand, most of them are in, you know, about where they were. You know, the Mike Pence did not have a particularly good fundraising quarter. Mm-hmm. Chris Christie did not have a particularly good fundraising quarter. I think Chris Christie is almost the entire focus of the Chris Christie presidential campaign is focused on that debate stage. Tim Scott walked into this race with an enormous amount of cash on hand. So pretty good but not great quarter doesn't mean that much. Haley is in okay shape. Doug Burgum and Vivek Ramaswamy can self-fund, so they don't really need to worry about that too much. There was some consternation about DeSantis. He's still got more than 10 million cash on hand. Had the second highest fundraising total. But the king of the fundraising quarter was Trump, which is, the guy who keeps telling us that he's worth $10 billion and all that stuff. God knows how much of that money will end up going to legal fees and towards mm-hmm. lawyers and things like that.
The guy's in my inbox all the time.
Yeah, and it seems to be working. Now, DeSantis said they're going to have a very different approach to fundraising, and I think they're certainly getting results that are okay. But I don't like poo-pooing the Hutchinsons of the world, but in a recent interview, Hutchinson said he wants to be in the top five in Iowa. Mm. Top five! Great, and I went back and I checked. That's Pete DuPont level numbers. That's Phil Graham level, fifth place in Iowa.
There was someone recently who had a similar ambition in Iowa. Who was it? I can't remember. A campaign that did not take off. But suffice it to say, Laura Ingraham was making fun of a couple Hutchison events that were just. It reminded me of when I went out and covered the Joe Lieberman campaign at some point. There were literally five people mm-hmm. in the room.
And so, if Hutchison is asking why aren't people taking him seriously? Well, because you want to be fifth in Iowa. That doesn't even get you any delegates, probably. It's kind of this, we've said from the beginning, there are a couple of candidates who don't act like they really want to be president, and they're campaigning for cabinet jobs or for book deals or for Fox News gigs or something like that. And there was, you know, on this past, both in the quarterly fundraising numbers and in just the general past couple of weeks, very little is dissuading me of that suspicion about some campaigns.
So, Noah, Jim said at the top there, you're in trouble if you're not Trump or DeSantis, but there's a case that DeSantis is in trouble, as Jim alluded to later in his answer. The fundraising numbers weren't great. The critique or the suspicion about his fundraising numbers is that the big number out of the box had kind of been pre-baked, you know, a governor leaning on a bunch of donors in a big state and getting a lot of people around the country to max out and give him money for the primary and then also for the general, which doesn't, latter part doesn't help him now. And it turns out that was largely true. There weren't a ton of small donors. And the problem with that is once someone's maxed out, the big donors, you know, they're not going to give to you again. So the advantage of the small donors is that you can come back to them again and again. And then the burn rate has been high. This has been a very big campaign, nearly 100 people. They've now cut some people, which isn't a great sign. And then they this afternoon, there's this highly touted, I think overly touted, interview with Jake Tapper on CNN, which ordinarily would not be a big deal. But since the DeSantis strategy, weirdly, unaccountably, was to avoid sit-down interviews where he might get hostile questions and might perform well and might be able to spread that for free media the way Tim Scott and Vivek and others have done in this early going, they just weren't going to do that, you know, because that would be lending credibility to the legacy media.
Well, DeSantis is in trouble. His campaign is communicating in no uncertain terms that they understand they're in trouble. And it's incumbent on us, observers of the political process, to recognize these signals and translate them for people who either don't recognize them or refuse to acknowledge what it is they're seeing. The DeSantis campaign is engaged in a shakeup, and it's engaged in a shakeup in response to the adverse conditions that are empirical and that are probably deadly if they do not get resolved. I know that there's a lot of people who are going to be resistant to that. Oh, it's early. Oh, it's just money. Oh, it's just a couple of staffers. Oh, it's just a media strategy. It's getting late. Gets late early out here, as they say. And because in that particular forum, you talked about Tucker's eccentric preferences and fixations, we happen to share a fixation. The American commitments to Ukraine's defense and the European war. We come out on very different sides of that argument. But it's one we both happen to know a lot about. And because I understand we know a lot about it, I understand that what Tucker was engaged in on that stage was elision and obfuscation at the expense of informing his audiences and at the expense of the candidates. DeSantis wasn't the only one to do this. Just about everybody on stage, with the exception of Tim Scott, articulated a apprehension with America's commitments, apprehension over the lack of an objective for victory, what have you, and demonstrating a willingness to adopt a more humble position vis-a-vis this particular conflict. No other conflict on the planet Earth, no other hypothetical conflict on the planet Earth, just this one. And then Donald Trump, who was not present, comes out the other day and says, well, how would you end this war on day one? And he says, well, I would do so by either saying, you know, Putin, negotiate, or we're just going to arm Ukraine to the teeth to the point where you have no choice to negotiate because you're just getting pummeled. And we're not, that suggests two things. One, we're not giving them everything that we could be giving them, which is an argument that has been leveraged by the populist right. And two, that his particular approach to this conflict is not tail between your legs, a McGovernite come home America strategy, which is the subtext that I hear too often from Republican voters and is a departure from traditional appeals to Republican voters. What I hear from Donald Trump's mouth, if you do the seriously, not literally thing, is that what we need on on the world stage is an extroverted America, a confident America, a forward-thinking America, maybe not an America that's blowing everything up, but certainly an America that is not shrinking from its role as the sole global hegemon. And I think that's an appealing message to Republican voters on an instinctual, emotional level, that I think every other Republican, again, with the exception of Tim Scott, has misunderstood in the effort to get in front of the crowd, follow the crowd where it's going, and jump in front of it to be their leader. They've all misunderstood a very fundamental and essential feature of the conservative disposition, which is not suspicious of America's power, is not hostile to the idea that America is a force for good in this world. And that's something that Donald Trump gave voice to, and I don't hear any of the other candidates doing so, because Tucker Carlson himself is hostile to that narrative, and he thinks that the wave of the future is this populist notion that the United States is a spent force that is better off seeing to its affairs at home and managing comfortably its own decline than asserting itself on the world
stage.
Have
you written that about Trump?
Yeah, I have. Okay. For National Review.
Okay.
It's called "Is DeSantis Misreading the Room?"
Oh, right. So, Charlie, what is what were your takeaways from Iowa?
Well, I thought that the configuration demonstrated the hierarchy within the American right at the moment. I didn't like that Tucker Carlson was the one hosting it, because by definition, that meant that Tucker Carlson's obsessions were injected into all of the questions and the framing. And those obsessions are not the same as the average Republican voters or the average American voters. But of course, there was very little that most of the candidates could do about that, because if they had declined to go, and then they would have been told that they were scared of Tucker, or that they were being disrespectful to an important portion of the audience. I say most because Donald Trump is exempt from that. Donald Trump can skip it and receive very little blowback. So I have come away from this thinking that Donald Trump is the most powerful person in the firmament, followed by Tucker Carlson, and then the rest of them sit below Tucker. Substantively, I thought that DeSantis did fine. He didn't do as well as everyone was insisting that he did, but I thought he did fine. I thought that Tim Scott did fine. But until we see them go up against each other, and until we see them go up against Trump, we're not going to know a great deal. It is just different having a format where you are subordinated to the interests of an entertainer and brought onto stage one by one to answer his questions, than when you are debating directly each other and the big dog in the room, unfortunately, which is Donald Trump. So I didn't think that it was in and of itself especially instructive. I did think that it showed us neatly the power configuration on the right at the moment. And perversely enough, the fact that Donald Trump skipped it just illustrated that he is in charge.
Yeah, I thought DeSantis, especially on Ukraine, was just over eager and trying too hard. And I think this has been an aspect of DeSantis's public presentation throughout. And some of it is just the way he is. He's earnest, which can translate in this kind of over eagerness. But on Ukraine, I'm just not convinced that that's what he believes or thinks. I think he's just aiming to please. So, exit question to you, Jim Garrity. Let's multi-barrel it. Percentage odds that Ron DeSantis is the nominee, Tim Scott is the nominee, Mike Pence is the nominee, Vivek Ramaswamy is the nominee.
I'll go 25-3-1-1.
All right, 25. So, Noah, DeSantis, Scott, Pence, Ramaswamy.
DeSantis, 20. Scott, 20. Pence,
whoa.
10.
Whoa.
Vivek, 5.
Whoa.
Tim Scott is highly underrated. Tim Scott is being very honest. Tim Scott is as likable as a politician can possibly get. He's very hard to campaign against. He's articulating narratives that traditional conservatives respond to. He's navigating unnavigable minefields and coming out unscathed. He's turning in very impressive performances. Does he appeal to the conservative affect in this particular moment, a disposition that likes combat for the sake of combat even, and perhaps because it's a losing fight? No. But if that mania that has taken hold of the conservative base dissipates, he's going to be very well positioned, and I think he's going to be an impressive candidate on the stump.
So what did that add up to, like 55%?
20, 40, 55, yep. Mm-hmm. So Trump has a 45% chance of being the nominee, which is still the pole position, but I don't think by any means it's assured.
Charlie?
I think DeSantis has a 25% chance. I think if Trump implodes, he's the obvious choice. I think he is going to have a lot of money. I think that he is trying to pull off a massive outreach and door-knocking and ground game campaign, and that will put him in a good position if the party sours on Trump as it should. I would then put Tim Scott at 10%. I could see him breaking out. If we get the George Will scenario where neither of them, for whatever reason, get it, I think Scott might be the obvious choice. I'd put Mike Pence really low, 2 or 3%. I don't think Mike Pence deserves that, but he is inextricably linked to Trump. And that is a difficult position to be in when you are running as an alternative to Trump. I think Vivek Ramaswamy has a 0% chance of being the nominee. That just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, I would say 15 to 20% DeSantis, 10% Scott, 5, maybe unfortunately being 5 is generous for Pence and 0 for Ramaswamy. I would say Trump is still the overwhelming all caps favorite in the race. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, Waterstone. When Patricia tried to donate to a conservative organization through her donor advised fund, her request was denied. Why? Because they said she was trying to give to a hate group. That's why she switched to Waterstone, a donor advised fund dedicated to upholding Judeo-Christian values. Waterstone is unique in the world of donor advised funds. It accepts gifts of cash as well as real estate, business interest, oil, and more that can help you receive an immediate tax deduction and make a difference for the charity of your choosing. With this charitable pool trust, you can even generate a guaranteed income stream from your charitable giving. Waterstone strictly adheres to a Christian statement of faith, including a pro-life declaration, and does not give to charities that contradict those values. Waterstone is trusted by so many men and women of conviction that they give $10 million per month in charitable grants. They can work with you or your financial advisor to make a giving strategy that fits your needs. Contact Waterstone's Giving Strategies team today for more information by visiting waterstone.org. That's waterstone.org. Please check it out. So now we've had this big debate over defense policy. The House passed just last week the National Defense Authorization Act for 60 years or something. This has been a bipartisan bill that passes Congress. It passed on a very narrow partisan vote. I think there were four Republicans voted against it, four Democrats who voted for it. And the reason for this is it had a number of anti-woke so-called writers, perhaps most importantly, targeting the Pentagon's new abortion tourism policy that was announced for political reasons in the wake of Dobbs. And there's been this argument from the Pentagon and from the administration and from various Democrats that if members of the military do not get paid leave and travel expenses paid to leave a state with abortion restrictions and get an abortion someplace else, our readiness will be affected. It'll put our troops at risk, and we will have little hope of actually defending ourselves from our adversaries unless female members of the military basically have access to abortion on demand. What do you make of it?
Yeah, you had a very good piece on this, which everybody should go read. It's called The Military Doesn't Need DEI. I think I'm going to tag that later on with some survey data, to sort of dive into what the Pentagon and specifically John Kirby, I think, was saying yesterday about how this is a real readiness threat. First of all, I haven't seen a lot of information to that. To substantiate that, my instinct would be to say that in a 80% male force, the members of which tend to be conservative and vote that way, the idea that this particular NDAA, which prohibits the Secretary of Defense from reimbursing or paying for abortion services, barring care programs that cover hormone treatments or sex change surgeries, that's the sort of thing that would affect readiness, seems to strike me as hard to believe given the makeup of the force. What does constitute a real readiness challenge for the United States military right now is recruitment. We're missing recruitment targets. And what's demonstrable is that the politicization of the Pentagon does reduce the pull for recruitments. One of the biggest draws for recruitments are family connections and personal encouragement from people who know the services intimately. And this is sort of thing that, according to surveys, leads them to discourage their associations and their family members from joining up. The National Independent Panel on Military Service and Readiness, the Heritage Foundation, picked up the survey, promoted it, and demonstrates pretty definitively this idea. 68% of service members say they witnessed moderate or significant politicization of the services. 65% are concerned about it. Another 68% of active duties say polarization influences whether they say they will encourage their children to join the services, and more or less say no. But these are not bigoted concerns either, which is the other thing that I think the left reaches towards to justify their social engineering of the services. People who serve believe that lowering the physical fitness standards reduced their trust in the military. They say that allowing transgender service personnel without restrictions to serve contributes to their declining trust. And even just distinct from the DEI stuff, social engineering objectives like mandating emissions-free vehicles across all the services. No diesel-powered vehicles in the services by 2027. 70% say that reduces their trust in the services. Why? Because they think all these decisions are going to contribute to getting them killed. And that's perfectly legitimate. It's actually pretty rational. And the arguments against them force you to subordinate common sense to some sort of higher ideals that are really very partisan and debatable at best, at the most charitable thing you can say about them. So yeah, I think Republicans are on pretty solid ground here. I think Tommy Tuberville has taken the government hostage, and there's a lot of antipathy and hostility towards that strategy, and it has some downsides to it. Confirming general and flag officers hasn't been going very fast, and it's been difficult for the services, I think. But no more than the paramount threat to the services, which is recruitment. And which's the bigger threat here, Tommy Tuberville or the DEI initiatives? I think the answer is pretty plain.
Yeah, so Charlie, what do you think of what Tuberville is doing? It's a classic instance of one guy using the sway that one senator has, despite the fact the other side hates it, and even some people on his own side hate it. You just know. Lloyd Austin imposed this abortion policy unilaterally, certainly stretching the law, maybe violating the law in certain respects. And yes, if I refuse to go along with unanimous consent for any confirmations or nominations, that's going to be a major inconvenience to a lot of people who had nothing to do with this. But the way to fix it is for Lloyd Austin to go back and reverse the policy. So don't talk to me. Don't point fingers at me. I'm just defending the prerogatives of the legislative branch.
Well, you know what I think about it. I think about it what I always think about it, which is that it's fine. I'm not a big fan of Tuberville's. I think he's mostly right on this, but I don't have to be a big fan of Tuberville's or to think he's mostly right on this to think that if the system allows for him to make a fuss over this, then he has every right to do it. There's no point having a system in which the legislature gets a say over this, or in which one part of the legislature can be ground to a halt by one person, if when that one person decides that it's time to make a fuss, he's not allowed to. If this is a problem per se, then the Senate should change its rules, which it could do very quickly. But I don't think those who are criticizing Tuberville are angry with him over the process. I think they disagree with him on the merits. He is clearly bothered by this development. I am bothered by the way that this has been covered, which is to reverse culpability.
Mm-hmm.
I keep seeing it said that Tuberville in particular and the Republicans in general are injecting the culture war into a military bill that usually matters related to the military, legislation related to the military, is outside of our culture war. But that in this case, the Republican Party, conservatives, have pushed it into the bloodstream. Well, that's nonsense. Objecting to innovations is not waging a culture war. It is objecting to a culture war. It's playing defense. If we went back to the status quo ante, which is what Tuberville is essentially asking for, and what the other Republicans who agree with him are asking for, then they would be content. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think he is asking for material changes to the way the military is run. He's complaining about policies that have been put in place by this administration, correct?
Correct, yeah. And Jim, this is just so annoying because the anti-woke writers are automatically described in the press as divisive and controversial, where almost by definition, if that's the case, the things they're addressing are divisive or controversial. At least you'd think so. But those terms, of course, are never used to describe the underlying policies, which are innovations. You know, it wasn't until recently that anyone thought the military needed to promote abortion tourism or to cover so-called gender-affirming care or to be suffused with DEI training.
Yeah, Charlie stepped on some of the things I was saving up for my answer. So I'll just very quickly say that, you know, this is another demonstration of how the left is the aggressors in the culture war. They take an established system that is working seemingly reasonably well and decide we want to make changes to it. And then when figures on the right object to that and say, wait a second, no, we don't want those changes. The coverage, often many parts of the media, suggests that the right is picking a fight over this. Well, no, you made that first move that prompted the right to respond. And just kind of a vivid demonstration of this came at the White House either yesterday or when John Kirby called abortion, quote, a foundational sacred obligation, unquote, of the U.S. military. No, it isn't. And, you know, it's thinking about how often you get gaslit over this. Think about how often things that the Biden administration thinks are mainstream and very popular are not. Affirmative action comes to mind. Vaccine mandates come to mind, you know, all of those. And things that they think are extreme are, in fact, pretty mainstream. You know, it's just another demonstration of this. I will make one minute quibble. Tommy Tuberville, good for him for standing up for what he believes in. I think this fight would be a little bit easier if the Republican senator who was leading this fight was a veteran leading this charge. I think people, you know, it just makes it a little easier for the Democrats to argue, this guy is some crazy cultural war conservative who doesn't know what they're talking about. I think Tuberville is right on a lot of this stuff, but I think, you know, it might be better if one of the other senators on the Armed Services mm-hmm. Committee was leading the charge.
So, Noah, who do you think, next question to you, who do you think is going to win this fight over abortion policy at the Pentagon, Lloyd Austin or Tommy Tuberville?
Well, Tuberville's winning right now. The House has passed this NDA and the Senate's been trying to figure out some workarounds and they wanted to do regular order confirmations and that would take apparently 84 consecutive 24-hour mm-hmm. days to do. Tommy Tuberville is presently winning the fight.
Charlie Cook, who wins?
I don't know. I think it's a toss-up.
Jim Garrity.
I could pretty easily see the Biden administration saying they'll go along with it, seeming to surrender, and then trying to sneak through the back door some other policy changes, kind of like they did with the student loan forgiveness.
Yeah, I think it's going to be – the Biden administration is going to have to move, and it might be a little bit like the debt ceiling where it's a loss for the Biden administration in the sense that they couldn't hold their maximalist – position, but it's not a victory, full-on victory for Republicans either. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, the Free the Economy podcast from CEI, health, wealth, and happiness, three goals that are essential to our lives, but attaining them is often impeded by heavy-handed government controls. That's why we must free the economy. Free the Economy is a weekly podcast produced by the Competitive Enterprise Institute that documents the opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment in a world with less government control. How can smart urbanism improve our lives? Where is economic freedom under attack? How can we unleash the potential of small business owners and innovators? Each week, host Richard Morrison offers news you can use and fascinating conversations with experts in their fields to answer these questions and more. I think we can all agree freedom is contagious. So check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit cei.org/freetheeconomy. cei.org/freetheeconomy. Please check it out. So let's return to 2024. We have this, Charlie, this no labels effort to potentially recruit and run a moderate or a ticket or a unity ticket. Joe Manchin is the most prominent and plausible presidential candidate who's interested in this effort. There was a forum, I think, last night, recording Tuesday morning up in New Hampshire. Jim wrote his jolt about this morning. What do you think about this effort?
Well, what do I think of this? I think a couple of things. The first one is that this is, in fact, a sign that there is dissatisfaction with both parties. There is a persistent feeling in certain elite corners that the Republicans are bad and the Democrats are bad, and that the truth lies somewhere between the middle, and that what we really need is someone who can bridge the gap, and that Americans are crying out for a third party. And I usually think that's not true. That isn't to say that the parties couldn't benefit from choosing different people. I think there is something to the idea that what America wants right now is a conservative Democrat. But typically, the no labels, third party, third way approach is something that is driven from the top and not from the bottom, and it runs into a buzzsaw. But that is not always true, as we saw in 1992 and in 1996 with Ross Perot's candidacy. And it's not always true even within the existing party system. As we have seen in recent years, outsiders running do well. Maybe not well enough to win the election every time, but well enough to disrupt. Bernie Sanders was seen by many voters almost as a third-party candidate who had come in to take over the Democrats. And Donald Trump was seen as a third-party candidate who had come in to take over the Republicans and indeed succeeded in taking over the Republicans. So I think we might be both dispositionally, and because Trump and Biden are broadly disliked and a majority of Americans don't want them to run, more open as a country to a third party run than we have been for a while. The second thing I think is that someone's going to do it. I have this ongoing debate at National Review with some of our other writers. I can absolutely see Joe Manchin doing this, especially if he becomes convinced that he can't win again in West Virginia, which seems fairly likely to me. I don't think that Joe Manchin is going to be reelected as a senator. And if he is sufficiently angry with Joe Biden, which he seems to be, for Biden's various betrayals in Manchin's eyes, and if he is, as he seems to be, persistently not a Republican, I can see him being convinced by influential and well-heeled people that this is his time. How that would play out in an election, I have absolutely no idea. I find it quite difficult to work out which party that would hurt or help the most, where the votes would come from. But I think we are probably closer to this happening and mattering than we have been since 1992.
All right. You stepped on my exit question, but that's okay. No more predictions about whether Manchin will do it or not from anyone else, please. So Jim Garrity, as I mentioned, you wrote about this today in The Jolt, kind of played out the scenarios of various tickets and whether they'd have a chance of winning at least one state, a native state here or there. The problem with this effort, as I see it, is it's a huge lift just to get on the ballot. You know, ballot access is no small thing. And then even if someone gets traction for a time, you get down to crunch time and this person might be a strong third or, you know, a second certain places, but it's still a wasted vote given the way the Electoral College works. And then you see a collapse in support.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of times where often in primaries, you know, there's three candidates or more, and that as we get closer to the election, you know, 2 weeks away, a week away, the third candidate starts shedding support and people start clustering around the top two who are most competitive. Very easy to conceive some sort of similar dynamic at work there. What I think I felt was most – first of all, it's worth noting the Democrats are apoplectic about this, and they absolutely – are treating no labels as if it is a, you know, heat-seeking missile pointed directly at Joe Biden's re-election campaign. Even, you know, claims of so first of all, they founded an organization just designed to stop no labels. Now, if you ask me, if you're going to do that, at least call it All Labels. But instead, they call it Citizens to Save Our Republic. The drama queens. But you know it's serious because Dick Gephardt is in charge of it. But anyway, Dick Gephardt claims that they've done polling, and if you have a third party, independent, bipartisan candidate out there, Joe Biden loses the presidential election by 5 or 6 points. Now, we don't have a national popular election, but if you're losing the popular vote by 5 or 6 points, then your chances of winning the presidency are not great, and it greatly increases the odds of Donald Trump winning. Most of the candidates that are out there don't really come from competitive states. So I don't just mean that their chances of winning their own state aren't great. But remember, like, you know, West Virginia, Trump won that by a ton last time. If you doubled Biden's vote, Trump would still win the state of West Virginia based on last year's numbers. So Manchin would have to do really well to steal that state away from Trump or swing it to Biden. Similar story, Louisiana, Bill Cassidy was being mentioned there. Larry Hogan in Maryland. I mean, you know, Biden won that state by 1 million votes last time. You know, he can give 500,000 votes and it won't do a darn bit of difference. Democrats are going to win that one. There are a couple other states. I mean, they mentioned Sununu in New Hampshire. I don't think he's going to run on a no-labels ticket, but I guess it's possible. Susan Collins up in Maine, you know, those are, you know, more competitive states. And probably the most interesting one is Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat turned independent, who is now looking, it looks like, a really tough race for re-election to the Senate, you know. But all of those states, you know, particularly Arizona and New Hampshire, they were swing states before this began. So I think they'd be swing states with no labels. They'll be swing states without no labels. And so when people say, oh, could no labels really cost, you know, Biden the presidency? One, it's way too early to tell. And two, you know, it kind of depends on which states they focus their efforts in. I think it's going to be pretty marginal, but, there's a reason they play the game, so we can see what actually happens.
So, Noah, speaking of marginal presidential campaigns, we have a couple of these going, and not just on the Republican side. We have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the Democratic side, gotten a lot of attention on the right. I was out at Freedom Fest with Jim Garrity, and there was a big event for RFK out there, and then a cozy sit down with various journalists, and these are not left-wing journalists. And then we get word of this tape, I suppose. I've listened to it myself, but the statement from RFK that COVID might have been biologically engineered not to affect Ashkenazi Jews or Chinese people. RFK says he's being distorted and is pointing to some study. What do you make of it?
I think it's indicative of the reckless and irresponsible paranoia to which RFK Jr. appeals. And it's evidence of why so many on the right and the left have suspended disbelief, subordinated their better judgment to giving this guy a platform in order to advance a political objective, which is to hurt Joe Biden. And it was utterly irresponsible. The substance of this guy's claim now is that European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews are European, are of a distinct ethnicity. This is not a religious affiliation. It's an ethnic distinction, as opposed to Sephardic Jews or Ethiopian Jews or what have you. And they're in league with the Chinese in order to produce and disseminate a deadly plague. This is about as medieval an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory as you can get. It is unalloyed bigotry. And if his supporters weren't so besotted with the persecution complex that he justifies, they would see all the accompanying paranoia that he regularly gives voice to, RFK Jr., as the ugly conspiracy theory that is of a piece with this one. From 5G corrupting your precious bodily fluids, to the CIA killing Bobby Kennedy, to Al Gore winning in 2004, to all his climate-related paranoia, it all boils down to a nefarious cabal executing profitable campaigns of obfuscation to benefit their friends at your expense. This is the essence of all conspiracy theories, which is why anti-Semitism is never too far from them. As my friend and colleague Abe Greenwald over a commentary has said very brilliantly, anti-Semitism lures in the background of almost all conspiracy theories because they all boil down to a powerful, nefarious group that is undermining your health, well-being, and benefiting their own. And that is the essence of all the conspiracy theories that he promotes. And it's there's a political angle to this, which actually dovetails with the Joe Manchin thing. A lot of the Democrats are obviously beside themselves over this notion that this threat from the center could take away some votes from them. But they're also beside themselves over the notion that this, the threat from the left, represented by Green Party, likely Green Party nominee Cornel West, is also existential. And the White House never seems to be willing to ask itself why everybody is abandoning the incumbent president. The incumbent president usually builds on his popular vote total to win re-election. They have to usually have to, and often do. But every event seems to come at the expense of Joe Biden's margin. Threats from the left, threats from the center, threats from the fringes. Why is Joe Biden hemorrhaging support, they never ask themselves. Why is Joe Biden failing to appeal to all these discontents? And I think they can probably settle on a narrative that places the blame on the voters because they're attracted to these fringes and they really shouldn't be. But it's obfuscation, and it's an effort to absolve themselves of their own failures. They have incubated these conditions. They have created the conditions for these paranoid, conspiratorial, outside the mainstream voices to gain traction. And they're the ones hemorrhaging support. So at a certain point, the Biden White House has to look itself in the mirror and ask, what the heck are we doing wrong? And probably they would do that before the votes begin to be cast, because it's not looking good.
So Charlie, 5 years ago or so, we would have looked at RFK and said, okay, this kind of paranoid style of politics blurring over into conspiracy theories is something appealing to the left. But now it definitely has traction among elements of the right.
No doubt. Conservatives keep doing this. They keep finding anyone who attracts attention or who transgresses in some way and assume that that person must therefore be worthwhile. They did it with Kanye West, doing it with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And quite literally, this topic has moved from the left to the right. It used to be the case that anti-vaxxers in America were crunchy lefties. I think I'm right in saying that prior to COVID, the most unvaccinated county in the US was Marin County, California. And the most vaccinated state was Mississippi. But now the right has picked up on this anti-vax sentiment. And because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one of its leading exponents, he's had his moment in the sun on the right, even though he's running for the Democratic nomination. I think part of that is that the right has become increasingly paranoid. I also think part of it is contingent. If the right had from the beginning jumped on COVID, I think we would have seen a continuation of the instinct we saw in Nancy Pelosi right at the beginning of COVID, which was to describe fear over COVID as being xenophobic or sinophobic. And we would have seen left-wing opposition to vaccines. I would just assume that the Chinese Jews must be feeling very good about themselves today. It's the equivalent of being vaccinated and boosted if you're a Chinese Jew. But look, the guy's a kook. He's always been a kook. He seeks out conspiracy theories. From what I understand, this claim is the result of his misunderstanding a footnote in a report that pointed to a very slight statistical discrepancy that he has now spun into a bioweapon. Now, you will find in medicine that there are little differences in the way that people of different races interact or respond to medicines, for outside of medicine too. I mean, there are some countries, for example, that produce people who are more able to drink large quantities of alcohol than others. There are differences in diabetes likelihood between Black Americans and white Americans. We are, or should be, able to recognize this without jumping to the conclusion that this was by design. But Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is not able to do that. He's never been able to do that. He is the sort of person who looks at a given consequence or result or anomaly and says that therefore must be. It is in a sense the equivalent of 9/11 trutherism, where people said, well, George W. Bush benefited in the polls from his response to 9/11, and then he won the election in 2004. Therefore, he must have planned it. This is a total non sequitur. And the inability to recognize that is a character flaw, and a character flaw that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has had on display. And I would finish by saying that in this case, the consequences are actually probably somewhat small. He said this, he will probably pay a price for it, or who knows. His other conspiracy theorizing has been profoundly damaging. And I know this because my mother teaches preschool children who are diagnosed with autism. The misinformation that he has inflicted on the public, the damage that he has done to the understanding of what autism is enormous. There are millions of people out there now who believe or suspect that the diagnosis that their child received must have been the product of a vaccine. It's just not true. And this isn't true either. It's not just something to chat about on a podcast. This stuff actually really, really matters. And I just really hope that this reminds the electorate that this guy's a kook.
Jim Garrity asks a question to you, coming back to Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin will run as the no-labels presidential candidate, yes or no?
I think it's more likely than not. So I guess that puts me in the yes category. No. I think he does not have a great chance at re-election. I think he likes being the center of attention and a mover and a shaker. And I think he'd rather not end his career by losing the Senate seat that he's had for a while after being governor for quite a stretch. So, you know, you do this. Look, the top level of success is probably H. Ross Perot, you know, getting a significant amount of the popular vote but not winning any states. But he makes him the center of attention. He makes him a big speaker. And I think it kind of – it's where his brand is. He enjoys being, you know, not quite a Republican, not quite a Democrat, being somewhere in the middle and telling everybody, why can't we all just get along?
Noah.
So, Rich, you mentioned ballot access, and Sam Stein reported yesterday that no labels will not present an actual candidate until Super Tuesday, once they take the lay of the land and detect whether or not there's an appetite for a third option. And I find the mechanics of that to be insurmountable. Unless that changes, my answer is Joe Manchin and John Huntsman or whoever will not run, because right now, as I see it, there's no real intention of running.
So, Charlie, to circle back, you're basically where Jim is?
Yeah, I think he might do it. And if he does do it, then the mechanics that Noah mentions will be taken care of early, because he's not going to get in and agree to that. That's what No Labels is saying at the moment. I suppose in some part to ward off these democratic challenges. I mean, I understand why the party is doing it, but the Democratic Party, for all its talk of democracy, is trying as hard as it can to ensure that this third party cannot run. They're trying to use the instruments of the law to get rid of this third party challenge because they suspect that it might lead to another Trump presidency. If Joe Manchin or whoever says, yes, we're going to do this, they will do it long before Super Tuesday, and they will do whatever they can to get onto the ballot.
So I think I'm a no, but there's a little uncertainty there because he's not going to win re-election to the Senate. He probably knows that and will not run for re-election for the Senate, which leaves the question, what is he going to do? And a lot of time these guys, they can't give it up, right? There's a reason Asa Hutchinson is out there speaking to very, very, very small crowds of people. I would say, you know, underlining Jim's point, Manchin's used to being in the uncomfortable spot where everyone hates him, you know, for not voting yet for Biden's latest spending initiative or whatever it is. But this would be a whole new level of hatred that would be directed at him, and his chances of success would be very, very minimal. So push comes to shove, I'm going to say no, but I'm less certain about it. I'm not certain about it, I should say. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way to support our really valuable journalism. We need a critical mass of people to pay, and a lot of people do pay. We're very grateful for it. But if you're not one of them, please examine your conscience and consider signing up for NR Plus today, tomorrow, or the day after. Our meter paywall goes away as soon as you sign up. If you sign up and log in, a lot of the ads magically disappear as well. And then if you want to, you can dig deeper into our community by commenting on articles and blog posts, coming to exclusive events with our writers and editors. We had one in Memphis coinciding with Freedom Fest just last week. And you can be part of Zoom calls with conservative figures and our writers and editors. So anyway, it's a great deal all around. And if you haven't already, please consider signing up. With that, Jim, speaking of Memphis, you were down there with one of your sons.
Yes, I would say my third favorite part of the trip to Memphis. Actually, conference was great. The NR Plus dinner was great. My second favorite thing was dinner with you, Rich. But actually, wow. You know, my younger is 13 now. His older teenager sibling brother is off at a college program for a couple of weeks. So it's just been, and my wife was like, wait, you guys gonna all leave the house at the same time? I get the house all to myself. You mm-hmm. could just see the glee in her eyes. But Memphis is a fun town. Other than a very hot and sweaty trip across the bridge to Arkansas, which did not turn out as well as I envisioned. The pyramid was a lot of fun. We went to the Rock and Soul Museum. We went to the Civil Rights.
What's the pyramid for uninitiated?
Oh my goodness. All right. So, you know, if you've ever seen the skyline of Memphis, there is this giant pyramid-like structure, which I guess was the home of the Memphis Grizzlies for about 2 years until the arena was finished. But it was built kind of with expectations that something great would go in there, and then it was empty for a long stretch. It is the world's largest Bass Pro Shops, and you're probably saying, well, how much fun could a Bass Pro Shops store be? Imagine that Bass Pro Shops decided to turn one of their stores into Disneyland with like giant aquariums and both a shooting range and an archery range. And oh, by the way, there's a giant hotel in the middle. Obviously, everything you could ever want for hunting, camping, fishing,
We should have stayed there.
It was pretty wild. It was a short walk from the convention center. So, anyway, just a great time and, you know, quality time with my son. So, you know, very glad to be able to tack that onto this speaking at a conference and the NR Plus event.
Great. Noah, you got some swim meets going on.
Yeah, mine's nowhere near as exciting as that. My oldest and my youngest are doing competitive swimming, but my oldest is doing meets now. And it's fun to watch him swim for the maybe cumulative 3 minutes that he gets to swim over the course of what I'm not even kidding are 4 hour engagements. It's the closest approximation to combat and war that I can imagine. It's just long periods.
I hope you bring lots of reading material.
Well, I mean, you know what? I probably should be, but part of the thing is that you have to be on. Because you never know when you can't hear the announcer say that it's your match. So you have to like be listening kind of closely, and the kids are all engaged with you. So it's not really downtime per se. You have to be on the whole time, and then really on during the match. But for the most part, you just have to be low level like engaged over the course of these 4 hours. So it's a real time commitment, but it is very rewarding to see him compete and do very well.
Charlie, you got your five-year-old an Aaron Judge shirt.
I did, and he wasn't grateful. Or at least he wasn't grateful at first, but then he slowly came around to the idea. I told him the day before it arrived that I had a little present for him, and he said, "It's not clothes, is it?" I thought, oh, no. Oh, this was great. So it was clothes, of course. And then when I took it out, he looked at it, and he said, "I'm just not that into baseball at the moment." And I thought, this is such a sad reaction. You know, usually he's actually a really grateful kid, unless we take him to the science museum. But in this case, he wasn't. But then, about 30 minutes later, he went back to the table where I'd put it. And without any further ado, he put it on. And then he started strutting around the house in it. And then he started asking me questions about the picture on it. He said, "Do you think he's hitting a grand slam in this picture?" I said, "Well, absolutely." And then he told me how much he liked it. So it had a happy ending. Right. But I really thought that I had, not to coin a phrase, but struck out.
So as mentioned, I was in Memphis for Freedom Fest down there with Jim and our colleague Carolyn and some of our colleagues from the business side as well. It was a great deal of fun. I participated in a panel discussion / debate on nationalism with a couple of folks, including Brian Kaplan, an economist at George Mason, who's quite anti-nationalist. And I thought, okay, I'm really going to get this guy. I'm going to say, you know, there is this, because he's like, nationalism is just associated with warfare and conflict, and that's a terrible thing. So I'm going to nail him. I'm going to say there was this nationalist movement around 1775, 1776 that decided it was going to break off from this colonial empire. There was a division in warfare over this, and wasn't this a terrible thing, this American Revolution? And he was like, yes, it was. So he was admirably consistent and principled. Also, as Jim mentioned, we had this NR Plus get-together, or I guess I mentioned it as well, at the Brass Door Irish Pub, and the proprietor, Seamus from Ireland, great guy. We just had a wonderful time. He was a wonderful host. So if you are in Memphis, if you're visiting Memphis, if you live in Memphis, you want to have a good meal and a good pint, please, please, please check out the Brass Door Irish Pub and tell Seamus that National Review sent you. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, as usual, a lot of strong competitors, but I'm going to go with our colleague Noah Rothman. Just a corner post called "The Great Tune Out," and you know, each year, each kind of time period in politics has a mood. But you know, this is kind of taking the launching point of donations being down in the past quarter, and just the the sheer number of Americans who dread the possibility of a Trump-Biden rematch, and yet how it seems like the Republican primary appears set to guarantee that. And I just think, you know, you look out of, you know, people were hoping things would be so much better after COVID. People still feel out of sorts. People still don't feel like things are back to normal or the way they ought to be. And just the idea of a rematch between the two guys, just so dreadful. So I just, you know, Noah just captures the spirit, the mood, the attitude of this time, and certainly hope we get to a more energizing and invigorating time period in politics in the not too distant future.
Noah, what's your pick?
The great Luther Ray Ables' latest, Quit Apologizing for Being American. It's a really enjoyable, fast-paced disquisition on the commodification of outrage and why so much of that comes to resemble self-hatred and why that self-hatred ends up becoming a projection of that hostility on the country of their birth that has given us the opportunity to have that sort of sentiment and express that sort of sentiment. And he thinks it's very misplaced, and I do too, and I think it's worth giving that one a read.
Charlie?
I want to read the book that is written about in the book section of the most recent National Review on Margaret Thatcher, the IRA, and the 2 minutes that changed history. This is a review of a book by Rory Carroll. The reviewer is Graham Hillard. That book is called There Will Be Fire, and it is about the attack in 1984 on Brighton's Grand Hotel, where the Conservative Party was holding its annual conference. I often read these book reviews and think, well, I don't really need to read the book now, mm-hmm. but in this case, I think the opposite. I think I'm going to order it.
Great title, huh?
Yes.
So I am surprised that my pick has been left to me. I had a backup, but it's Yuval Levin's Corner Post about this Bastille Day, a tweet from Antony Blinken saying the War of Independence and the French Revolution were fueled by the same aspirations for freedom, democracy, and human rights. And Yuval Levin subjects this to the critical scrutiny that it deserves in a way that only Yuval is capable of. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast and your rebroadcast retransmission. Recount this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schitte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Noah. Thanks to Waterstone and the Free the Economy podcast. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.